Welcome to The Lob, your home of in-depth coverage and analysis by These Football Times, a movement of journalism you can trust. Each week, we endeavour to bring you the very best coverage of the game, exploring stories from the past and present with analysis by expert guests from around the world. Find more of our award-winning content online and in print. In the meantime, enjoy the podcast.
The Uruguayans had offered to pay all travel and accommodation costs, but only France, Belgium, Romania and Yugoslavia bothered to make the long journey from Europe. As for Brazil, they were still in the shadows of the River Plate.
Hi, and welcome to another series of The Political Football. After four series of looking around the world and back through time to examine how football and politics seems to be inevitably and inextricably knitted together as part of the social fabric of life, we decided to take a different tack with Series 5. Across the coming months, we'll be devoting each episode in this series to a particular World Cup tournament, ranging from the first tournament in 1930 up to and including the scheduled one in 2020 in Qatar. In the company of a number of typically brilliant and knowledgeable guests, we'll look in depth at each tournament, considering the wider political situation at the time, how and why politics were involved in the awarding of the tournament, and any issues regarding location, plus, of course, the movers and shakers at the heart of these things. With regard to the tournament itself, we'll also look at any political aspects involving players, teams, and key rivalries. It's a new slant of the political football theme, and one that we believe will offer some fascinating discussion. We hope you'll like it. Today we're kicking off with a tournament that got the whole ball rolling in the first place, the first ever World Cup held in Uruguay in 1930. As ever, sitting in the co-host seat alongside me is my political football comrade-in-arms, Stu Horsfield. How you doing, Stu?
Hi, Gary. You okay?
Yeah, I'm looking forward to being back on the political football bandwagon for another series. It's going to be fantastic, and much kudos to you, mate, for suggesting we do one in the World Cup.
Yeah, well, I'm not sure about that. I just got a bit panicky that the series was coming to an end. And then right at the end of one of the episodes, and it was like, oh, we could do another one. We could do another one about World Cups. Like, we don't need to end the party yet. The band don't need to break up yet.
That's right. The song goes on forever, mate. The song goes on forever. So, who's our guest today, buddy?
It's brilliant. I love this guest so much. Today's guest, old friend of the Political Football podcast and the Lob podcast in general with us, is Mr. Paul McPowell. And Paul's a senior writer at These Football Times. He's also written for When Sassy Comes magazine and The Football Pink, and just has the best way of telling stories about football.
I'd absolutely agree with you, mate. There can be a better guy to just kick the series off. How you doing, Paul?
I'm doing fine, Gary. How are you?
I'm good, thank you, Martin. Looking forward to getting into some talk about the football and the politics of the greatest show on earth, in terms of football at least.
Yeah, look forward to that myself. And how are you, Stu?
Very well, thank you, Paul. Like I say, I love the Political Football podcast series. I'm too young, I believe, yet to stop learning, so I've managed to twist Gary's arm and get another series out of him.
I think that's an excellent idea.
Okay, so Paul, why did you pick this tournament? What particularly interests you about the first World Cup above others that you could have perhaps chosen to talk about?
Yeah, well, I think the first World Cup is always unique, isn't it? You know, I think there's probably a generation around these days. I think the World Cup has been around forever, but you know, it's still less than 100 years old. It's quite a recent addition, you know, to the football, you know, to the footballing world. So it's always fascinating to me, this first World Cup, because, you know, how did it come into being? How was it organised? Why was Uruguay picked? And then, of course, as with being the first in any competition, it had to succeed. It had to generate enough interest and enough revenue to make the competition worthwhile to continue. So from that aspect in particular, I just found the whole process fascinating. And no, without this World Cup, there is no World Cup. No, the behemoth that we have now would never have existed, but for those pioneers who took the brave and bold decision to go ahead and host the World Cup in arguably the smallest country to this date that has still ever hosted the World Cup. It was such a brave and pioneering decision, and you know, Jules Rimet and Henri Delaunay, who were the brains behind this, who originally had the idea back in 1904 to host the World Cup, you know, that they were so influential in making sure the competition took place. It's also linked to the developments of FIFA, the kind of the battle between FIFA and the FA for establishing world kind of dominance in footballing terms. And it also brought together a clash of the new footballing world and the old footballing world as well. So from every angle that you look at it, and then that's without even considering the logistics of trying to organise a world competition in the 1930s without mass air travel being available to the participants as well.
And if anybody was wondering why we considered Paul to be the ideal guest to kick off this tournament, that is the answer. Now, I mean, the fantastic introduction there, Paul. Obviously, some people may or may not know that the World Cup was sort of born of the Olympic Games, as it were.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, FIFA themselves actually, you know, were given the responsibility of organising the footballing component of the Olympic Games in the 1920s, and did so in particular for 24 and 28. But at that time, the divide between amateur footballers and professional footballers was becoming quite an issue for all the authorities across the globe. I mean, the UK authorities, you know, the Home FA, they pulled out of participating in 24 and 28 Olympics because of this issue of amateurism, which kind of fell down on this concept of broken time payments, that although you're supposed to be amateur, you could receive a payment from your employers for taking time off to be in the Olympics. And so, therefore, there was some debate about whether the teams participating in the Olympics were truly amateur or not. And it got to the stage where, you know, FIFA, who planned this competition for a number of years, as I said before, decided the time had come to firmly establish that this World Cup will be open to professionals and amateurs, and on that basis, things got moving quite quickly from 1928 onwards.
Yeah, I guess, you know, money in football ruling how the game develops is nothing new. There's nothing new under the sun, is there?
No, there isn't. But, you know, from a home nation's perspective, you know, it was... We'd already made that difference clear between amateurs and professionals, you know, quite a few years beforehand, whereas for a number of countries, there wasn't a clear divide, at least this way. Football not being part of the Olympics, being open to anybody, regardless of whether they were professional or not, it was a unique opportunity suddenly emerged for FIFA to establish themselves as A, the leading sort of arbiter of world football, but B, to realise their dream of having a world-based football competition.
Yeah, Stu?
I say this every time, really, sorry. I was just thinking here, Paul, and obviously, you know, you mentioned there, I mean, you know, you have the outbreak of World War One in 1914. I think you mentioned, you know, the idea being mooted around since 1904. And you might not know the answer to this, but realistically, was 1930 sort of the earliest possible date that the first World Cup could have happened, or was there anything that sort of stopped it from happening before then? You know, the Olympics had been around from 1896, sort of, you know, 24 years earlier. I just wondered if there was anything... 34 years earlier. I was just wondering if there was anything that had prevented the World Cup from happening any earlier than 1930.
Well, I think one of the main issues was that when FIFA was first established in 1904, initially there were only seven nations who joined FIFA, so straight away you've got a limited pool there from which to organise a World Cup. The home nations joined it in 1905, I think, and then the numbers expanded, but even by the time you got to sort of a First World War time, I think FIFA only had about 47 nations, and lots of those didn't even have a fully functioning national team. So in terms of being able to put together a viable World Cup competition based on football alone, I just don't think the numbers were there, and I don't think the infrastructure was there as well. And the other thing that was a big concern was that FIFA was quite adamant that any country hosting a World Cup competition would have to bear the 90% of the cost, which at that time, both before the First World War and at the end of the First World War, was a huge undertaking to ask any country to commit to. And I think FIFA was also desperately hanging on to try and get the UK nations to show some ambition to become involved in a World Cup competition. But, you know, at the time, our respective FAs were very, very isolationist and just kind of felt they had nothing to learn from these, you know, these foreign journeys in terms of how to run football.
Yeah, yeah. You mentioned how the visionaries Rime and Henry Delaunay were instrumentally setting this up. But a lot of people would know the name of Jules Rime, because obviously his name was tagged onto the trophy for quite a while. But people will perhaps maybe less knowledge about Delaunay. Can you tell us a little bit about him? And I think he's also integral to another series we do on the European Championship, isn't he?
Yeah, he is. That's right, Gary. I think Stephen Scragg, you know, gave us a good bio on Delaunay in the first European Championship podcast that we did. But basically, he was someone who was a footballer, and I believe that, you know, during a football game when he was young, got the balls. Took him in the mouth, knocked two of his teeth out, and as a result of that, he switched from playing to being a football administrator. He was more the sort of the visionary of the partnership. I mean, him and Jules Rime as a partnership lasted for the best part of 50 years. I mean, they both died within a year of each other in the mid 1950s. But Delaunay was the one who was really, really pushing to get the World Cup going. And he actually served, I think, as FIFA Secretary from 1915 to about 1955, which is an incredible period of time to be in charge, you know. I'm sure Seth Blatter modeled himself on him, you know. but, yeah, he was, you know, he is such a leading figure in the game who maybe doesn't get the credit he deserves compared to, like, Jules Rime and people. But also, it's worth bearing in mind that the first president of FIFA who actually suggested the World Cup competition was a guy called Robert Agar, who was frustrated by his inability to get the home nations on board in terms of their competing in a World Cup, and came up with the famous quote that negotiation with the British is like trying to slice water with a knife.
Yeah, there's probably certain members of the EU Commission would probably agree with that.
Yeah, I said about to find out.
Any thoughts, Tim?
Well, one, it sounds like Rime and Delaunay are like the Lennon and McCartney of early world football. we've obviously, you know, we've mentioned the home nations quite a bit, Paul, and I was just, I suppose, my own personal interest as well, is obviously England was, you know, was seen as the country that sort of gave the game to the world, but why? Is that the main reason why there was such a desire to have the home nations on board with any global tournament in order to give it any sort of credibility?
Yeah, I think you nailed it there, Stu. I think the initial thoughts were that to have the home nations, who were the founders of modern football, as participants in the first global trophy, was seen as being a massive plus, you know, for FIFA, who, you know, don't forget, we're also struggling to kind of establish themselves as the world governing authority, you know, compared to the FA. And I think part of the problem FIFA had as well was the home nations took the view that they had the premier international tournaments within their own islands in terms of the home nations championship. So they didn't really see any reason to get involved in playing against what they deemed to be lesser opposition.
There's always that sort of European arrogance about it, isn't it? You know, and it's, I mean, some people would argue it still exists to the day in certain fields. We've got this sort of the idea developing of having the tournaments, and you mentioned about the difficulty of picking the location. So I'm going to guess a couple of questions. So firstly, why did it end up in Uruguay? And secondly, you mentioned about the difficulty of travel. So how did they manage to induce European teams to go over there, and did any particularly people drop out for any spurious or non-spurious reasons? 17 questions there in one go, Paul, do you remember?
that's fine, Gary. So to go to your original point was why was Uruguay chosen? Yeah. Well, at the time, based on the the evidence of the 1924 Olympic Games and 1928 Olympic Games, when Uruguay had won the competition both times, and it's kind of established himself as the de facto reigning world champions of football. They were obviously considered that FIFA was interested in being involved in hosting competition. Now they had some European rivals, Holland, Italy, Sweden and Spain also, proposed to host the tournament as well. However, the four European nations apparently made it quite clear that under no circumstances would they be sending teams to South America because of the logistics involved. Now, Uruguay, for a young country and desperate to kind of establish itself on a world stage, they made the bold decision to actually agree to totally fund the costs of the World Cup competition themselves, which basically blew the it was almost like sky blowing ITV out the water with the Premier League TV contract offer. They kind of said they would totally fund everything for the participating countries. So on that basis, the other European nations pulled out, knowing that they couldn't compete with that. And Jules Rimet was desperate for it not to be hosted in Europe because he just felt it would not be seen as a world competition if it was hosted in, on European shores. So therefore, he was very, very supportive of the bid from Uruguay. So the bid was accepted, I think, in 1929. Uruguay had about 6 months, effectively, to get themselves ready to host the World Cup competition, which is incredible. Lots of the European teams would not part because of the difficulty of travelling to Uruguay at that time, because the only way you could get there realistically was on a cruise ship, so the team's travel plans had to fit in with those little holiday companies. And then the other complication alongside that was the European nation trying to organise for their star players to get time off work. And about a month before the competition was due to start, no European nations had actually agreed to enter the World Cup, so effectively it was just going to be a South American championship. Now, Uruguay as host and South America as a continent were quite infuriated by the perceived sort of a colonial attitude that the European nations infused to come across, even bearing in mind that Uruguay and Argentina had travelled to the Olympics in Europe in 1924 in Paris and 1928 in Amsterdam. So they felt quite slighted by the idea that the European nations weren't going to come. So in the end, it was left to Jules Rimet to really use his influence to get France to participate. The vice secretary, who was Belgian, managed to get Belgium to participate. And then, I think we'll talk about it a bit later, King Carol of Romania, who was a massive football fan, decided to enter his team, and he put pressure on Yugoslavia to enter as well, which they did. And that left four European teams to participate in the contest. So there were seven South American nations. You had Mexico and the United States from the rest of the Americas, the four European nations, and Egypt, who I'm going to come to a bit later, who were the initial teams who were going to participate. The original idea had been for the competition to be a straight knockout competition, but because they only had 14 teams, that meant it couldn't be a straight knockout competition. So therefore, they went for the group format. Although in 1934 and 1938, they went back to the knockout format as well. So the whole future of the World Cup actually could have been quite different if the 1930 World Cup had been based on a straight knockout competition, because the logistics of sending a team halfway across the world to play one game and being knocked out wouldn't really have been the best way of setting the competition, I don't think.
Absolutely. I think I read somewhere that the French team 15 days to travel from France to Uruguay to compete. And it's interesting that you mentioned about the pressure, the political pressure that was applied by to get the French and the Belgians and to some extent the Greeks and the Yugoslavs to compete and travel to the competition, which, as you said, perhaps if there, that political pressure hadn't been applied, the tournament might have faltered and we wouldn't have the World Cup as a tournament that we have today.
Yeah, I think that's right, Gary. And you touched there upon the travel arrangement. So I think the French team, the Belgian team and the Yugoslav team, the French team, the Belgian team and the Romanian team travelled across on a cruise ship called the Conte Verde, which had actually been built in Scotland in 1923, amazingly. And it took them 15 days. So on the cruise ship, you had three rival nations cooped up on the ship together for 15 days. You also had Jules Rimet himself clutching the World Cup trophy in his hand luggage, also travelling across the Atlantic. You had a number of European referees, one of whom refereed the final, also travelling across. And that cruise ship actually picked up Brazil from Rio as their final port of call before arriving in Uruguay. So you just can't imagine today, you know, four different nations all travelling together to play in the same competition.
That's true. Obviously, what would I say? The Greeks a bit of revenge, obviously. Yeah, but yeah, absolutely. Stu?
It's such a wonderful story that almost defies belief. But but obviously, before we get into the tournament, I'm quite interested with regards to how the IOC and how the Olympic movement saw this, the manifestation of a football tournament that, you know, would ultimately become its own entity and sort of marginalise football within the Olympics eventually. But, you know, was the support from the IOC? Were the IOC very against it? I have a lot of questions. Like Gary, you know, did FIFA feel that they needed to remove the premier football competition from the Olympics and put it under their umbrella almost to legitimise their organisation?
Yeah, I mean, I think there was definitely elements of that too. But the main thing was, you know, if the Olympics were still going to be adamant that only amateurs could participate in the Olympic Games, then almost immediately that ruled out most of the major football nations from being able to participate, because, you know, professionalism was quite clearly, you know, a major factor in most of the countries that previously played in the football elements of the Olympic Games. So I think from, you know, the Olympic Committee at the time, I guess, were of the view that, you know, well, if you're not going to participate as amateurs, then, you know, there's no role for you in the Olympic Games. And it's quite interesting that after FIFA had the 1930 World Cup completion, that football was not part of the 1932 Olympic Games. It was withdrawn completely and not reinstated until 1936. And in some ways, if you take the view that what FIFA did was just get rid of this whole issue of professional footballers and amateur footballers, because quite clearly, the 1930, if you're a professional footballer, you could play in the World Cup, whereas according to the Olympic rules, you couldn't.
Yeah, it is.
So, given the sort of situation between the IOC and the nascent tournament that FIFA were promoting, can you give us a little bit of a background of the wider political situation at the time around the globe and how that might have affected things?
Yeah, well, I think in some ways the political situation around the globe may have played in Uruguay's favour, because, you know, the big, towards the end of the decade, 1929, that was the Wall Street crash, which particularly affected, you know, the first world nations quite adversely, whereas South America, to an extent, initially, did not suffer the same repercussions as the Wall Street crash as many of the European nations did. Secondly, I think it was also a time, the Wall Street crash also led to like a quite a significant increase in immigration from European countries to South America as well. I think in particular, you know, there was a huge exodus of Italians to Argentina. I think Uruguay's population was increased dramatically, you know, during the late 1920s, early 1930s. So I think the actual world economic climate at the time actually favoured Uruguay, because this was a country that, you know, appeared to have money, appeared to be able to finance the competition as well. And from the South American perspective, both, you know, it gave them a chance to establish themselves, give themselves a sporting identity, because none of the South American countries could actually claim to have a historical identity as independent nations, because I think Europe had been independent for 100 years when the 1930 World Cup came around. So there was that element to this as well. And of course, there were issues in Europe, you know, obviously in the rise of Nazism in Germany, the rise of fascism in Spain, and Italy. These also impacted upon whether these countries could participate or not.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know whether there's ever a time when the world isn't in political turmoil, but certainly there was a lot going on at that time. And perhaps you'll touch on the Italian migration to South America, particularly Argentina, because it sort of feeds back into the story a little later on. But any thoughts around that, Stu?
And I just think, I mean, you've just absolutely got it absolutely right there, Gary. You know, the world seems to be in perpetual turmoil, I don't think the word sort of pioneers can almost be overemphasized. I mean, we take these tournaments, these, you know, mega events as they're now called, the Olympics, the World Cup, the European Championships. But at some point, it was somebody or a group of people who were brave enough to put forward the idea, and who had the drive and the will to sort of make sure that these events happened. And yet they were doing it in the most complicated, complex political times. Sometimes I don't think these people get enough credit for what they did. The tournaments that we have now, you know, including the Olympics, the World Cup, you know, we would never have had if it wasn't for almost the belligerence of these people that we're talking about tonight.
Yeah, that's right, Stu, as well. And when you think of the European nations being involved, you factor in, you know, a 2.5-week transatlantic crossing, you know, a competition that lasts about almost 3 weeks, then another 2.5-week back to your European bases. So it's almost like kind of 3 months of the year has been taken up by participating in the World Cup. So you can understand why there was some reluctance upon the European nations to commit themselves to that. And if they, you know, all the four countries that participated, you deserve immense credit for taking the bold step, because if they hadn't, if it had just been a South American competition, then the World Cup, as we know today, may never, ever taken effect.
I'm sure that's true, yeah.
No, I was just about to, obviously, as always, you know, agree with Paul. It is, I just don't think it can be almost overemphasised how crucial the role was, and you know, Paul makes a great point there about the teams and the players, you know, that actually went and believed in the tournament and actually allowed it to happen. You know, I mean, obviously we don't know a world where there isn't a World Cup or an Olympic Games, but it's, you know, there were such fine margins and such fine threads at the beginning that these tournaments were hanging on, that it's, you know, it could quite easily have been possible that we could have had one edition of it and never seen it again.
No, that's right, Stu. Yeah, I think as well, if you also, you know, go back to those times, so in terms of the media coverage in Europe and in Great Britain in particular, the World Cup competition almost didn't exist. You know, there was no massive build-up to it. The papers, you didn't get a special 1930 World Cup supplement with the Daily Herald or whatever. It was completely bypassed. You know, there were no souvenir cards, photo collections, anything like that. You know, you couldn't even buy a social kit with your team. And so, so these nations, no. So given the lack of publicity, you know, it was almost the competition had to succeed. I mean, I think the Manchester Guardian was the only British paper that sent a correspondence out there. Even then, that was just for the final itself. And the lack of coverage, you know, in Europe was quite poor, really. And I think the players themselves, when they landed in Montevideo and they docked, and they were almost taken back by the thousands of people waiting to greet them on the quayside, because it was such a contrast to the low-key departure from Europe.
Yeah. Just before we get the ball out and talk about the tournament itself, I just want to just ask you to comment on the fate of Egypt, which you mentioned earlier. We'll come back to that now. And perhaps how what happened to Egypt might have influenced the development of football in Africa.
Yeah, I mean, it's one of the great, you know, what-ifs of the World Cup competition, probably similar to India's non-participation in 1950. But Egypt had agreed to be part of this first tournament. And at the time, Egypt had quite a decent football team, because they had made the semi-finals of the 1928 Olympic Games. So they would have stood a realistic chance. But once again, they couldn't get on the first cruise ship that had been booked by the teams I mentioned before. So they were going to come on the SS Florida with Yugoslavia, and were due to meet them in Marseille to travel across to Uruguay. However, when they departed Cairo, they kind of got caught up in a massive storm and couldn't get across the Mediterranean. And by the time the conditions improved and they docked at Marseille, the cruise ship had gone. It didn't wait for them. And so they had to send a telegram to the authorities in Uruguay saying, sorry, we missed the boat. We're not going to be there.
Yeah. What effect do you think that would have had on if they hadn't participated and done well? Yeah, as you know, would have been quite likely given the successful team that they had. Would African football perhaps have been quicker to develop the respect it has? Where, you know, for a sort of this is sort of, I guess, a fairly new phenomenon.
Yeah, possibly, Gary. Yeah, I mean, I know Egypt took part in the 1934 World Cup, but were knocked down in the first round. And I think one of the difficulties the African nations had in trying to kind of establish themselves as footballing powers at the time was the issue of colonialism. So you had places like Mozambique and Angola where their best players were just selected by Portugal instead. And you had likes of Algeria and Libya, which were colonised by the French at the time, and their best players were taken by France. So I think a number of the African nations struggled to actually get their best players to represent their countries because their so-called colonial powers took them away from them.
Yeah. And there again, politics and football, what can much of money going to do? So the tournament itself, the four seeds for the groups, the individual four groups, were three South American countries and the USA. So none of the European teams were seeded. Was that sort of a political decision, a home decision, as it were, do you think?
I don't think so particularly, because if you take the view that the Olympic Games prior to the World Cup was the best way of judging how strong a footballing nation was, then the finalists were Uruguay and Argentina, so quite rightly, they should have been the first and second seeds. The other semi-finalists were the USA, so the seeding as well. And I think the one country you might have a reservation of might be Brazil, and I think it might have been quite a politically sensitive decision to have seeded Uruguay and Argentina and not to have seeded Brazil at the time. So I think one of the seeds certainly is a question mark about. But the other three, I don't really think you can say that they shouldn't have been seeded.
Well, yeah, OK. Stu?
Yeah, I mean, like I say, I've just asked the question about how, it was so brave to put on this tournament, but it certainly seems that once, apart from choosing a country that was so far away, so far away from almost anywhere, it seems that they got it right. They got the format of the tournament as best they could. The seedings were correct. Obviously, you've mentioned there about Brazil, Paul. But it's not. I don't know. It's almost like it seemed to have been given that the very best chance that it could to succeed, apart from arguably geographically where they locate it. And I understand the reason for it needing to not be in Europe, and that's right. But in terms of Uruguay and where that sits in South America, it just seems so far away, and it's almost like that they made the best of what they had with regards to the location that they picked.
Yeah, I think I'd agree. Sure. I think in some ways you have to credit the Uruguayan authorities for being quite futuristic in terms of what they were proposing. And they made the decision to base all the games in Montevideo, which cut down on the travel for the nations that had come across the Atlantic as well, which assisted masses. They also built a brand new stadium to host a competition, the Centenario Stadium, which was, for its time, was a stadium like which hadn't been constructed anywhere across the world before. So it had the capacity to hold 100,000. It was almost designed like a Roman amphitheatre with the running track around the stadium itself. It had the massive statue looming over the ground, the Torre de los Homenajes. And so in terms of a venue to host the World Cup, it was brilliant. The only problem was it wasn't ready on time.
And another thing where nothing changes really. So many things in these days. Just want to touch on because obviously because of what we were saying about the difference between travelling between the continents, and there wasn't much intercontinental football at the time. Obviously, the referees and interpretation of the laws of the game must have been fairly relevant. As I understand, there were only a small minority of referees from Europe, with the vast majority from South America and Mexico.
Yeah, that's my understanding as well, Gary. I think there were 11 officials from Uruguay. But I think this age-old issue of, you know, the difference in refereeing in South America and Europe has never really gone away, you know, 19 years down the line. It's still an issue today. But I think at the time, you know, controversy about refereeing decisions, you know, certainly was nothing new in the 1930s. And I think... I don't think it was an issue for the visiting teams, the fact that the officials were going to be South American, although there was an issue in the Cup against in terms of a few timekeeping issues by one of the referees. But, as an art, you know, refereeing was nothing like the refereeing that we know today. So, you know, lots of referees refereed the game in blazers and ties and plus fours and things like this, you know. So it was quite a whole different feel to the event. And you know, you have to have huge admiration for the four referees that came across from Europe, because, you know, these days, can you imagine if, you know, the guy refereeing the World Cup final was the guy who travelled with one of the teams on the plane in the final itself and I'd mingled with them all the way over there. And, of course, you know, it's just beyond belief, but that's the way it was. And I think, you know, at that time, 1920s, 1930s, you know, mistakes by referees were hugely commonplace.
Yeah, you mentioned that. When I was researching this, I found a little nice little thing. I've got this thing about referees and mistakes. I've got these oddities, and apparently this guy called Almeida Rego, who was the Brazilian referee, and he was refereeing the France-Argentina game. I think France were playing for the second time in 48 hours, crazily enough. And they won the first game against Mexico, and they were drawing with Argentina, and although they had a couple of players injured, and they were sort of almost playing with 10 and a half players. And a French guy called Marcel Languier was clear on goal, and the referee blew for full time 6 minutes early. it was through on goal with a chance, which probably would have been the winning score. And obviously the French protested massively against it, and the game restarted, and they eventually lost 1-0, a goal by a free kick from Monty, who we'll perhaps mention a little earlier. So refereeing controversies and errors, and you know, and they didn't have VAR or apparently efficient stopwatches in those days.
No, and that France game you mentioned there, Gary, was quite interesting, because the France have played twice in 3 days. They played the first game on July the 13th because they were adamant they weren't going to play on Bastille Day, and they wanted to celebrate Bastille Day. So they played on July the 13th, had the day celebrating Bastille Day on July the 14th, and then played the next game on July the 15th. So can you imagine that now? You know, like the England team asked to celebrate St. George's World Cup game, it just wouldn't happen. And also, there was quite a large French population in Montevideo, so the Argentinian team complained that they'd been kept awake in their hotel all night by the Bastille Day celebrations as well.
Yeah. I also read that the Bolivian team wanted to sort of, I don't know, favour or just show homage to the host, that they wore a legend on their shirts saying "Viva Uruguay."
That's right. I mean, can you imagine us to listen now? You know, you know, playing Argentina, the only team where Las Malvinas on the chair, so the gesture of friendship, it didn't happen, would it?
I think not. Stu?
I mean, obviously, we weren't there, and I suppose this is more just, you know, your sort of thoughts and opinions on this, Paul. And, you know, we will get into the tournament a bit more, but do you think that the players, obviously, like Gary mentioned, there wasn't much intercontinental football, and obviously there's a World Cup, and the, you know, the title of world champions was at stake, but do you think it was maybe seen more of a festival of football as opposed to, obviously, the, you know, the incredibly competitive element, you know, that we have now? I just wondered if sort of what you thought, how the players might have perceived this for what was essentially a great adventure with football in the middle.
Yeah, I think there's both elements too, in my opinion. So I think for the South American nations, you know, Argentina and Uruguay in particular, this was a winner or cost competition, and by any means possible, they were going to win. And the national service and both countries
sure that was the case. I think for the European nations, it was a completely different experience. I mean, you arrive at a major competition and have to spend 15 days on a cruise ship, so you're not quite in the frame of mind for going out and giving you all, wouldn't have thought. So I think the European perspective was certainly different from the South American perspective. So, yeah, I think the point you made about the European nations, probably it was seen as almost like a holiday of a game of football, though, and possibly I don't think any of the European nations realistically expected themselves to actually progress in the competition. But for the South American countries, you know, in particular Uruguay and Argentina, bearing in mind that Uruguay beaten Argentina in the 1928 Olympic final, Argentina beaten Uruguay in the 1929 Copa America. So for those two nations, there was an awful lot at stake.
Yeah, well, like I say, it's funny. It was just with, you know, with sort of with what you were saying there. It just, you know, it just seemed to strike me almost, you know, France playing and quite happy to play 48 hours later, but they're definitely not playing on Bastille Day. It's almost, it's you know, it has that almost vibe of a festival, like you say, for them. Whereas obviously, like you know, you said there, you know, Uruguay as Olympic gold medalists were de facto world champions, and then now this was the, I suppose, their opportunity to actually prove it in name, as well as deed.
Yeah, that's right, Stuart. I think there's a few quotes from some of the French players who kind of said the 15 days on the cruise ship going to Uruguay is the best 15 days of their life, you know.
Yeah, I bet it was.
For a working-class footballer who spent their life living in rural parts of France and suddenly be whisked away, you know, with silver service, swimming pools, you know, drinks on call on a cruise ship must have been some experience.
Yeah, well, like I say, the whole thing just, you know, it just seems to be just incredible. I mean, you know, you think of the World Cup and you think particularly of the tournaments and results and winners and who, but you know, this is a fascinating story, purely just not including the football. The football is almost secondary in this competition because everything is so new. It's like the football, you know, almost has a backseat to the narrative of this World Cup.
Yeah, that's right, Stuart. And of course, as you kind of alluded to there before as well, because this was the first competition, you know, no one knew what it would mean to win the World Cup, what the implications would be, you know, whether it would leave them in footballing history. You know, I mean, Lucien Laurent, who scored the first ever World Cup goal for France, had no idea how significant that goal was to prove over the years. So there certainly was that element to it, that, you know, it was a huge step into the unknown. And of course, when they participated, they had no way of knowing whether there would be a second World Cup or not.
Yeah, it's absolutely fascinating. Sorry, Gary, sorry.
No, it's great to hear. I guess, you know, we're sort of looking at this, back at these things now, what we consider, I suppose, oddities and, you know, strange situations, but they're just, I guess, reflective of the, you know, the politics of the situations at the time, and, you know, very much the same as the some things that people might look askance at, you know, in the tournaments around currently, made it the same. But, you know, we're all children of the political situation we live in, aren't we?
Yeah, I think that's definitely the case, Gary. You know, we've said before, the fact this was the first competition, and, you know, things could have gone badly wrong, you know, and the whole competition may not have gone on and developed, but in terms of, you know, laying the groundwork for what the competition was going to become, you're just full of admiration for these people, who had the zeal and the determination to make sure this competition went ahead, despite all the possible, you know, obstacles. I mean, I believe it even snowed in one of the first games in the World Cup in Uruguay, which is just incredible.
Okay, so we sort of talked a bit about the teams there. So let's sort of draw a sharp focus and let's look at some of the individuals that, you know, took part, be it from players or managers. Anybody particularly of interest? I mean, you mentioned the King of Romania, actually, earlier, so, you know, we'll perhaps touch on him as well. But let's start with players. Any sort of, you mentioned about the Laurent, is the guy who scored the first goal?
He is, yeah. And then was taken out by Monty in the next game between Argentina and France. So Monty left his immediate mark on the competition there as well. Yeah, he was the scored the first World Cup goal. And as we say at the time, he didn't realise the significance of that. But, no, I think in his later years of life, it gave him a sense of great pride that he'd been the first person to score a goal in a World Cup final, and that can never ever be taken away from you.
Yeah. I suppose anybody listening who likes quiz questions, you know, there's one to log in. Everyone sitting down, somebody says, "Let's have a World Cup quiz."
Yeah. And in some ways, you could argue it was quite fitting that Jules Rimet, who was French, had organised a competition. It was quite appropriate that a Frenchman scored the first goal in the World Cup. So maybe there's something quite poetic about that, and maybe were meant to be.
Yeah, indeed. Anybody else worthy of mention?
We talked about Monty there, didn't we? Who was the Argentinian hard man, who I think Chelsea come into contact with in 1929 on a tour of Argentina, where he kicked one of their players in the testicles when the referee wasn't looking. And apparently there's a school of thought that Chelsea thought they were treated so savagely by the teams they played at the time, that kind of influenced the FA's decision not to send the side out there for the World Cup in 1930. And I'm not sure that's true or not. But he had apparently that was the case. But obviously Monty had a certain reputation. I think he was also responsible for breaking the leg of the United States player in the semi-final.
Correct.
Yeah, so he added a new definition to kind of the term hard man. But of course you had a Castro, the Uruguayan forward, who had cut part of his arm off when he was 13 with a sword in an accident, and he played with one arm throughout the competition, and apparently he wasn't averse to using his stump of an arm to jab people in the stomach and back and things when the referee wasn't looking. So he seems to be quite a character as well. And then you had the Uruguayan captain, Nazazzi, who was known as the Marshal by the fans because he was the one who kept the teams on track, made sure they kept their focus to win the World Cup itself. You had Guillermo Stabile, who came into the Argentinian team for the second game because the team captain, Ferreira, was taking a law exam in Buenos Aires that day and had to miss the game. Came in and ended up being the top scorer with 8 goals. So there were definitely a few players who made their mark in that tournament as well.
Yeah, we'll come back to Monty when we get to the final, no doubt, and what happened after him afterwards, and another answer to a quiz question. But tell us a little bit about Kim Carroll of Romania.
Yeah, I mean, with all the stories going on at the moment, the press coverage of Harry, and you're trying to be in this situation where Prince Harry agreed to take charge of England for the next World Cup, and was putting some charge of the team and picking the players and things like that, because basically this is what happened with Romania, that, King Carroll, who had not long been on the throne and wasn't particularly popular, just happens to be a massive football fan. He absolutely loves the game. And to some extent, the enduring popularity of football in Romania can be traced directly back to him for his enthusiasm for establishing the game. And he was determined that his country was going to be represented in the World Cup. So he gave an amnesty to any Romanian player that had been suspended by their own FA to ensure that they could compete in the World Cup. And then apparently the largest employer in Romania was a British oil company, and lots of the players, the best players, also were employed by this company. And apparently he gave the owners an ultimatum. It was a British company as well. Either, you better let these guys give them time off for the World Cup, or there's going to be severe consequences for you. So based on his determination, that's how they managed to get the best players from Romania to participate in the World Cup. He also put pressure on Yugoslavia to participate as well, because I think he didn't want to be the only Balkan country sort of there to be represented there. And apparently he led the training sessions on the cruise ship for the team as well, so he'd be in charge of kicking the ball around, practicing, shooting, things like that. And he was determined that they were going to make a good impression. And to some extent, they were quite unlucky because they did actually, they were in a group of three as opposed to a group of four. And although they managed to beat Peru 3-1 in the first game, which, when you think about it, after getting off a cruise ship, to play your first game against a South American country that didn't have anything like the travelling problems that you had, they beat them quite convincingly 3-1, and they were quite unfortunate to lose their next game to Uruguay. Although the 4-0 scoreline kind of gives an idea it was convincing with Uruguay, it was 1-0 at half time, and Romania were definitely in the game. And if you want another quiz question as well, that Romania-Peru game, the first one they played in that group, still holds the record for a lowest attendance as a World Cup finals game of approximately 300.
That's great. That's great. I'm writing all these down in case I ever get asked these questions. I guess with Kim Carroll, I don't know how old he was, but I mean, the two questions have really come to my mind. A, was he attempting to pick himself to play? And B, was there any doubt of being sacked after they got knocked out?
No, I don't think there's any danger from being sacked. That wouldn't happen. Whether he might intend to pick himself, I don't know. I think he was so concerned with the country performing well at the World Cup finals that I think he was quite happy to leave it in charge of his players. However, he did take control of the coaching, the tactics, certainly every day on the cruise ship and during the competition itself. So, he was a bit of a playboy as well. And there are rumours that a number of his mistresses were also involved in team selection as well. But I don't know what we'll do just that one.
This is wonderful, Ted. I mean, so it's more of a playboy than a player boy, I suppose, in that case.
We keep the fans as being the first competition. Can you imagine a situation today where a member of the royal family will come? It's between the team is leaving the train, and threatening to close factories down unless players are released to play for the country.
Interesting.
That's true. It's for obviously, mentioned obviously the great sort of tale that you've told there. And I was just thinking there with regards to sort of this tournament and Jules Rimet and sort of the creation of this tournament. Was there a lot of political lobbying at a political level, or was it mainly done within the country's FAs, or did he have to go to the sort of whatever the particular ruling party or political leader was of each of these nations in order to sort of promote and establish this competition?
Well, I think because FIFA, when it was first set up, were quite determined that each country would have its own football association and therefore, in theory, should be apart from political influence. I think it was more the work of the national associations that Rimet and Delaunay kind of tried to harness there. Now, obviously, within certain countries, the national association could have been quite weak and could have been suspect to political manoeuvres, etc. But I think in terms of getting the competition going, I think Jules Rimet and Henri Delaunay worked with the respective national associations to make sure that the competition went ahead. And they did, as I said before, they did try extremely hard to get the British nations involved, but they were treated with quite contemptuous disdain in terms of trying to get them involved.
So moving through the competition, the massive South American rivalry between Uruguay and Argentina actually was sort of picked up again in the final. But before we talk about that, I want to ask you about the Uruguayan manager. Is it Sapici?
Yeah. Well, I mean, from the research that I've done, I think at the time managers were kind of managers in name only. They ran the training sessions. They might have a role in tactics, but both him and his Argentinian counterpart is Olazal. I don't think that they were particularly involved in the selection of players. I mean, to an extent, it was the senior players who kind of chose who would be playing for the side. So I know that prior to the World Cup final itself, one of the Argentine players, Pancho Barrero, who'd been suffering with a knee injury, gave himself his own fitness test in the morning in front of his fellow players by kicking a ball against a hen house a few times. And based on what the players saw, they picked him for the team and overruled the manager. So I think in terms of managers having a role, I think it was quite limited, apart from King Carlos of Romania, who I think his I think his word is law. And obviously, if you were a Romanian player and you wanted your place on the cruise ship back to your country, you made sure you did what the king said.
So we mentioned earlier about the seedings and the semi-final teams were Argentina against the United States and Uruguay against Yugoslavia. But neither of those games were particularly close, were they?
No, I think, some people take the view that the USA team is actually a British team because there were six British-born players who were actually playing for the USA. And they're quite a vigorous physical style. I think the French team refers to them as the team with shot puzzles or something like that. Quite a derogatory term. But by the time we got to the semis, the USA, Argentina semi-final, but basically, by all accounts, Argentina just totally intimidated the US side. One USA player had his leg broken by a monkey in the first 10 minutes. The USA keeper got quite a bad injury after another severe challenge by an Argentinian player. And you may have heard this one as well, but apparently the US coaching staff was so incensed by Argentina and the fact that the referee was not doing anything to put a halt to it, that at one stage the US medical assistant came onto the pitch and was so annoyed he threw a bottle of chloroform down on the pitch in protest and ended up knocking out one of his own players who couldn't play for 10 minutes.
So
just absolutely bizarre stuff. And I think in terms of the Yugoslavia semi-final, I think it was quite a surprise that Yugoslavia actually got to that stage. Even more so because Yugoslavia team, the Serbian team, the Croatian team, was huge part of that side. So they did really well to get that far, but I think by the time we got to the semi-final stage, there was only one team going to win that game.
Yeah. Okay, so we'll move on to the final, and Uruguay and Argentina, which is a fairly sort of intense... I mean, so many, you know, beat Uruguay, Argentina, Brazil, you know, there tends to be this sort of, you know, internecine massive rivalry between these countries, and I guess this was no different.
No, I think you've absolutely summed up correctly, Gary. I guess in terms of a World Cup final, in terms of the proximity of the two nations, I think arguably they might have been the closest two nations to have played each other in a semi-final, you know, separated by the other plate, but you can divide the two countries. But yeah, massive rivalry between two countries and sporting, cultural and historical sense as well. And you know, I think the build-up to the final was incredibly intense, as you would expect. So 15,000 Argentinian fans made the journey across the River Plate to see the game. However, once again, weather conditions kind of prevented a few of the boats from actually landing in Montevideo in time to see the final. So some arrived just to the Uruguayan celebrate on the quayside as they're getting off in. Which could have been a rewarding experience for the team. And the police restricted the capacity to 90,000. The stadium could have held 100,000, but we didn't. And I think before the game, the head of the Uruguayan police came out of this quote that we're going to make sure that not one Argentinian revolver gets into Montevideo. So all the Argentinian fans were searched as soon as we got off the strips of the quayside. And from all accounts, you know, the atmosphere in the stadium was hugely intimidating for the Argentine supporters, to the extent that a few of them wore the Uruguayan scarves so not to draw attention to themselves during the game. So, yeah, there was a huge antipathy, animosity between both countries. And we mentioned before, you know, Argentina considered themselves the best team in South America, having won the Copa America in 1929. I think in terms of Copa America, Argentina won it 6 times, Uruguay won it 5 times. So there was an intense rivalry there. I mean, Brazil had only won it twice at that stage, but they won the series instead of rival by either nation. So it was a real struggle for dominance of the River Plate, B for dominance of South America, and C for dominance of the world. And that both sides knew that whoever won that game would have established themselves as the first ever world champions of football. So yeah, there was massive amounts at stake for both countries.
Yeah, you mentioned intimidation, and I wrote an article about Monty, I don't know, 12 months or so ago, and his granddaughter tells us the story that he related that Argentina were winning 2-1 at half time, and basically that the Argentinians received a letter, a message, or some kind of information that it would be for the best of all parties concerned if they lost the final in order to preserve the safety of their families. Now, In the second half, Uruguay scored three goals without reply and cantered to the title. But it's tempting to sort of ask the question: is that true, or was it true? Is it likely to be true, or was it just a sort of a plaster for defeat when your team collapsed? Or given the sort of less than total security around the issue at the time and the intense rivalry, both politically and sporting terms between the countries, is it likely to have happened?
Yeah. I think I've heard you ask for Gary. I know you always do meticulous research on these contributions. I think undoubtedly there's a massive amount of intimidation there. I mean, I think even in the group stage, we talked before about the Argentina-France game. Even in that game, the Argentina FA complained to the organising committee about the bias the crowd had shown to them, because at the end of the game, apparently, Uruguayan fans evaded the pitch and cheered off some of the French team on their shoulders and were throwing objects and being very intimidating to the Argentinian officials. So there had been some of that beforehand. I think prior to the final itself, the Argentinian hotel was definitely subject to threats, noise, all sorts of things, trying to keep the players away prior to the game. And you mentioned Monty there as well. He in particular was a bit of a hate figure for the Uruguayan fans, and they seem to be determined to make their mark on him. And I think to a large extent they succeeded. I think even today, Monty is still blamed by large elements of Argentine society for the fact that they lost the World Cup, because he just didn't compete to the level he normally would have done in the group stages. And there's also the controversy about the ball as well, because prior to the game starting, both there hadn't been an agreement about what the official match ball was going to be. And in the group stages, both countries had used their own ball from their respective countries. So when it came to the final itself, both sides wanted to use their football. Now, there's bits, evidence of this story may be true, may not be true, I don't know, but allegedly there was a tossing of the coin beforehand and the Argentinian ball was selected to be used for the match. However, allegedly, at half-time, the Uruguayan official was changed the match ball, and for the second half, a Uruguayan manufactured ball was used for the game. Now, whether that had any some results in us, I'm not sure, but it was definitely some skullduggery going on behind in the background there. And I think as well, I mean, if you read lots of reports from the Argentinian players about the aftermath to the final, I think in particular Pancho Barello mentioned that, they knew they were going to be intimidated, and some of his players thrived on the intimidation. They were ready for it. If anything, I see motivates them more, but they just felt like St. Monty actually let them down in the final. And he came up with a quote to think that at half-time, they thought they'd won the competition. They completely outplayed the Uruguayans. They really thought they were going to go on to win the competition itself. And in the second half, for whatever reason, they just never got to grips with the game. And I think there was a key moment when the final was kind of a 2-1-2 Argentina, when Barello hits a tremendous shot from the edge of the box that hit the angle of the post and crossbar. If that had gone in, that would have made it 3-1. That probably would have been game over, but it didn't. And then Uruguay came back to win 4-2.
Yeah, you just mentioned about the ball. It's a whole new sort of can I have my ball back, please?
It's just totally bizarre, isn't it? This idea now that you bring your own ball to the game. There's not an official competition ball that has been approved by all the participating nations, and I think even like just 90 years on, it's that defeat still hurts Argentina. I think Pancho Barrero was the last player from the Argentina side to die in 2010, and in one of his interviews before he died, he still says, it's a game I do not like to remember. It's a game we should have won. We were winning 2-1. We were making the dance, and then we blew it away. It still hurts to this day. I hate to be reminded of it.
Yeah. I mean, we mentioned just sort of touching on Monty again. It goes back to what you were saying earlier about the Italian emigration to South America and Argentina in particular. Because 4 years later, Monty was back in the World Cup final, but wearing a different colour shirt. And I'm sure we'll go into more detail. We'll look at the 1934 World Cup in our next episode. But he was one of Mussolini's Arundi, wasn't he? That he was deemed to have Italian parentage, that he would qualify to play for Italy. Strangely enough, in that final, instead of being told he'd gone to lose or he would suffer, the Italians were told in the final by Mussolini, we've got to win or they might suffer. So he had death threats either way, in, apparently in two different World Cup finals for two different teams. So, you know, there's another sort of question Claxon there, guys. He was the only guy to play in two World Cup finals successfully for different countries.
Yeah, it's a good one, like that, yeah. And I'd realised that to read your article about some while ago. Yeah, it's definitely another one to stump the quiz teams across the country as well. I think going back to final as well, you kind of forget that in the days, you know, without the mass media, for the Argentinian fans who couldn't actually get tickets for the final, the only way they had of following what was going on was to stand outside the press offices of the local Argentinian papers in Buenos Aires. So apparently on the day of the final, there were up to 50,000 fans standing outside the newspaper offices waiting for score updates to come through from the final, which when you think about it now, it's just such a totally bizarre experience. Also as well, the final is the only another crucial question here for you, Gary. It's the only final not to be played on a weekend, it's played on a Wednesday. So in Buenos Aires, General Motors, who are one of the major employers, closed down the production lines for the day. The whole country closed down for the day so people could do their best to follow what was going on in the World Cup final.
Brilliant. Brilliant, Paul. Brilliant. Steve?
It's fascinating listening. It really is. And I suppose, again, you know, like you just talked there about the, you know, about the Argentine fans and, you know, listening outside of, you know, journalistic offices and so. And I was just wondering, Paul, with regards to, you know, you have this new tournament and no one knows what to expect and, you know, Uruguay get to host it. And I just wonder whether, sort of over the duration of the tournament, whether this, you know, the tournament amongst the Uruguayan population and the interest builds, or whether it was always there and, you know, it maintained a high level, or whether as the tournament progressed, so the fervour sort of built and built until it, you know, until it reached fever pitch, if you like, for, you know, in the final.
Yeah, I mean, there's probably both elements there, Stu. I mean, certainly, I would guess that one of the reasons why FIFA were quite happy that Uruguay were going to host a competition was that they knew there would be a fanatical home support. And certainly for the games that Uruguay were going to play, most of those games would have sold out, which effectively they did. But I think as the competition progressed, maybe more and more people who, I mean, probably similar to the 6-6 World Cup in England, maybe more and more people who weren't initially particularly footballing orientated, more and more wants to be part of this national celebration, because it just gave Uruguay a unique chance to establish themselves on the world stage. And also coincide with the 100 years anniversary of Uruguayan independence from Brazil. So it was, you know, it was a momentous occasion for them as well. So definitely, I think the whole country got wrapped up in it. And I know, you know, some people query, well, how could that be with the competition taking place in Montevideo? How could the rest of the country be involved? But at the time, I think about 60% of the Uruguay population actually lived in Montevideo. So basically, Montevideo was where everything was happening. So, yeah, I think definitely, you know, the country got caught up in national affair. And now, I suppose the more interesting point would be, if Uruguay had actually played the United States in the final rather than Argentina, whether there would have been the same level of intensity. I think the fact that it was a Uruguay-Argentina final, that absolutely upped the stakes considerably.
Sorry, just one other question.
No question.
I'm sorry.
Go.
So obviously, on the sort of the day of the final, was there a large political influence within the crowd with regard, you know, politics, how we think of it, you know, with the, you know, the ruling elite of Uruguay at the time, were they very much in attendance at this occasion?
Yeah, I think so, because at the time, I think the 1920s, both for Argentina and Uruguay, was a time of massive expansion for both countries, and we touched before on the increasing numbers of immigrants arriving in both countries. When we mentioned the fact that, you know, to a large extent, they've been sort of immune from the immediate effects of the Wall Street crash. And I think for, you know, Uruguay's ruling elite, this was a chance to prove that, you know, they had established themselves on the world stage, that this is a fully modern country, this is a country that was going places, this country was the future, compared to kind of the impending chaos that was looming across the Atlantic in Europe. This was a real chance for Uruguay to make claim to be, you know, the model of a modern state.
Yeah. I want to ask just a couple of sort of loosely linked questions, Paul. Because one of the teams that didn't compete in the in this World Cup was the Austrian Wunder team.
That's right.
Who were pretty much at their height at that time. You know? So I know it's an impossible question, but you know what the hell, still ask these questions. So I'm going to throw one in as well. So I mean, firstly, why didn't they compete? And B, how well do you think they would have done if they had?
Well, I think, I mean, the major reasons for Austria not competing would be the same that can impact on most European nations, that basically the players didn't want to take 3 months, give up 3 months of their time to go travelling to a competition in a far-flung country. That was one factor. Didn't want to be away from the families for that length of time particularly, or the country for that length of time. So I think because... I guess Austria might have took their lead from Germany as well. So when Germany didn't participate, Austria kind of fell in line with that as well. And going back to our earlier conversations about the home nations not being involved, I'd wager the bet that if England and or Scotland had participated in that first World Cup, that might well have encouraged other European nations of the standing of Austria to take part. But no, the fact that the home nations didn't kind of set a marker that this competition wasn't valued. On that basis, maybe the Austrians kind of thought, well, it's pointless sending our best team out there because there's nothing to stay here.
So he's, you know, quiz question klaxon going off again in my ear. who are the only world champions to reign unbeaten for 28 years? And, you know, the answer to that is Uruguay, because they went in 30, didn't compete, they opted out. In 34 and 38, winning at 50. So 24 years. They didn't lose it until the 1954 World Cup. So what was the political ramifications about Uruguay opting out of the 34 and 38 competitions that were held in Europe? Was it just sheer logistical issues, or was it political retribution for European teams not competing in their championship, as it were?
Yeah. I think it was the last of their responsibility. I think the Uruguayans actually felt quite insulted by the fact that, you know, they had to almost go on bended knee to get any semblance of a European nation to participate in what they saw as an absolutely prestigious competition for their country and for FIFA as well. So, yeah, I think they were just infuriated by the way they've been treated by the Europeans. I think they were doubly infuriated by the way they've been treated by the home nations as well. So there's a definite element of, well, you wouldn't come to us, therefore we're not going to you. And as I mentioned before, Uruguay and Argentina both travelled across the Olympics in 24 and 28 that took place in Europe, so they'd shown they were prepared to travel to play football. But I think they felt so insulted by the lack of support they received from many of the European counterparts that they just decided it wasn't worth the bother of going across to defend their trophy.
Yeah, I can understand that. Yes, Stu?
I mean, for me, obviously, you know, this has been fascinating chat, as I absolutely knew it would be, and I think having listened to all of this, Paul, and, you know, I still come back to, you know, obviously there was more than just two of them, but, you know, Jules Rimet and Henri Delaunay, and obviously their names are sort of synonymous with two trophies, but having listened to all of this, do you think they actually get the recognition they deserve? Or because their names are associated with trophies, it's almost, that's them. It almost takes away what it was they actually did, because people just associate the names with the trophies and therefore they must have been important without actually seeing or really understanding their actual value to the game.
Yeah, I think that's a very cogent point, Stuart. I think, I think there's probably a whole generation of people who know what the Jules Rimet Trophy is, but don't know why it's called the Jules Rimet Trophy. And I think, you know, in terms of footballing history, I think if you do a random search of, say, Wikipedia, for argument's sake, Henri Delaunay hardly rates about two paragraphs in terms of his contribution to what he did with the game. So, yeah, I think to some extent, both of those two have been kind of airbrushed from history. But maybe we're looking at that from a British perspective. I don't know how they viewed in France, because I would have thought in France, and the fact that they just with these, you know, the World Cup, you know, they are lord of every possible occasion. And I think as well, the fact that we didn't participate in the World Cup till 1950, I think, excuse me, in the British media, never quite got the prestige or honour or accolades that he deserved for his visionary concept of what a football and World Cup would look like.
I mean, it's a great point. It's a great point, and it's an awful indictment of our almost colonial past and isolation. You know, how we view them in the UK, like you say, perhaps how they're perceived, you know, on a wider scale is, you know, is a very good point, Paul. Thank you.
I think as well, Stuart, I mean, you know, we touched upon lack of media coverage in the UK. So I mentioned before, the Manchester Guardian, as it was called at the time, the only one to cover and the competition. And they referred to it as this so-called World Cup. You know, all that phrase, this so-called World Cup. And the match report, it was about a paragraph. And they got the score wrong. It referenced the score as Uruguay 4, Argentina 3, which quite really was not the score. So, and it was like tucked away, you know, in the middle of the sporting section. It just did not get any coverage whatsoever. As far as I'm aware, there's no like PAT News coverage of the competition either, which when you think of all the things that were covered by PAT News in the 1930s in the cinemas, also seemed absolutely incredible. It was just, you know, the lack of coverage from the British media was quite frustrating. And I think, you know, there was usually a weekly sport journal called the Athletic News that made a few passing references to the competition in the most scathing terms possible. And I've got a quote from here. There's a quote saying, "I don't know how football can continue in countries such as Uruguay and Argentina. Surely they will kill off all the referees. Their crowds are so intimidating." So there's a real like snooty nose. Look at these uneducated bottomers trying to play. They know how to play the game worse than British. We know how to play it. But the lack of coverage is absolutely appalling.
It is.
I hate the clock on these times because, you know, I get engrossed in these conversations. It's such great fun, you know, and you know, to have somebody like yourself, Paul, who sort of comes with such knowledgeable descriptions of these things that happen, it's fascinating to listen to. And we've always had the same closing question on the political football, and we've finished each one of the episodes, but because we're on a different sort of subject, I've tweaked it a little bit. So, you know, you're getting the first chance to get the new question, Paul.
Thank you for that. I'm not sure if that's an honour. But go on.
I think it's probably one of these questions that we probably know the answer to, but I'd like to sort of heave a reasoning for it. So, football and politics are intrinsically linked, and there's hardly any doubt about that. But the question is this: can the World Cup, a tournament that large, ever exist without political interference?
But I think the simple answer to that, Gary, is no.
Well,
I think, you know, the there's too much at stake, both, you know, both the governments and, you know, also multinational industries as well. And I think you know, the scandalous awarding of the World Cup to Qatar in 2022 just, you know, demonstrates, you know, the appalling influence of the political machinery in affecting sporting decisions and sporting outcomes. So, sadly, no politics has always been part of major sporting competitions. And I know we're going to talk about this for a couple of weeks' time as well, even though from our perspective, politics played a massive part there as well. So, yeah, undoubtedly, you know, major sports and competitions are always going to be influenced by insidious political views.
Yeah. Any final thoughts, Stu?
For me, like I say, it's a wonderful start. I don't think we could have asked for a better start, Gary, to the series. We couldn't have asked for a better guest. You know, it's great that someone stuck their hand up for the very first World Cup tournament. If, you know, we could have started in 1934, but Paul was kind enough to start with 1930. And I think, you know, for people who hopefully are listening now, will now, you know, that sort of the story of the world, or the backstory of the World Cup now, will become so much more, I know it will for me, but will become so much more evident as to how we've arrived. You know, we talk about Qatar in 2022 and how we arrived there from such inauspicious beginnings on cruise boats and we'll use Maribor, no, we'll use Maribor beginnings to what we're going to have. It's just going to be a great story, and you know, Paul's kicked it off brilliantly.
Yeah. I think as well, just go back for more final snippet from the final as well. So apparently the Belgian referee, I think it was Jean Langenus, before the game demanded that, you know, his refereeing officials, his refereeing team would be protected, to the extent that at the end of the game he'd organised for a police car to come and collect them when the final whistle went, whisked him straight out of the stadium, and he was on a cruise ship that was leaving an hour after the game finished, so he was out of the country before there could be any repercussions whatsoever. I mean, absolutely fabulous. You know, you just couldn't believe that. But I think, you know, I give the final word to Jules Rimet here. You know, when he boarded the ship back to Europe a few days after the final had finished, you know, when interviewed, he was saying that the competition has been a major success and delighted for it. It was a man's game, which is, you know, quite a way of putting it about how physical the game would be. But you know, it's a man's game played by men. It was a splendid final. So he came back delighted with how his vision had worked out, because it could have gone so badly wrong. You know, things could have, teams might not have arrived there. They could have been delayed by the weather. There's all sorts of things that could have gone wrong, but he stuck with this. And I'm sure he, on his way home, I'm sure he enjoyed his Pernod and lemonade as a celebration.
Well, I guess we owe thanks to Monsieur Rimet for his diligence and application. Otherwise, we wouldn't have the tournament that we all enjoy certainly at the moment. So thanks to him, and a massive thanks to you, Paul, as well, as I mentioned earlier. You know, the ideal guest, and to say you knocked it out of the park would be underestimating your contribution, mate. So massive thanks for coming on to talk to us about the 1930 World Cup, buddy.
No, thanks, Gary. A massive thanks to you for having the idea for the series. And massive thanks for preparing the outline of what we're going to talk about. And once again, massive thanks to Stu. You know, me, if Jeff Stelling wants to learn more about how to use Stu's your man.
I couldn't afford him. I paid him too much. Okay, so that's the opening episode of the Political Football, the World Cup series. Thanks for listening. Next time we'll be back looking at the 1934 World Cup tournament with another exceptional guest. And we'll look forward to you joining us then. So thanks for listening and bye.
Many thanks for joining us today on The Lob, a These Football Times production. For more of our content, check out our award-winning print magazine featuring some of the game's foremost writers, artists and photographers, exploring areas of the game rarely covered in high-end print. For now, we look forward to you joining us again soon.